I hope I'm not too much out of turn. I was coming here to visit Nyesh, one of your organizers, even before the conference was set up. And then they figured as long as I was here, I should give this talk. So I'm happy to do so. I'll be reporting on some work that's in this paper, which has recently been accepted for JCAP and is done with Shunpei Miao. Let's see, where is she? Right there. If you get confused about which of us it is, she's the pretty one. So it's about a fine-tuning problem in scalar-driven inflation. So let me just remind you about the geometry of cosmology, homogeneous and isotropic geometry, where I'm using co-moving time, spatially flat sections, Hubble parameter defined as that, first slow roll parameter defined as that. And one might define inflation, or I think people, as the manifold fine-tuning problems of inflation are becoming more and more widely leading to greater and greater revulsion in people, there's a big tendency of people to try and separate the mechanism that drives inflation from a phase of early accelerated expansion. So I will follow the burgeoning usage of defining inflation as positive expansion with first slow roll parameter between 0 and 1. And if you define inflation that way, then the case is just overwhelming that you need it. Is Will Kinney here?
No,
he's not here. He wrote a nice paper called Inflation or What, where he showed just how overwhelming it is. And I think I probably don't even need to make that case here. But what caused it is a mystery. There's a huge...
You're lucky that Neil is not here. Neil Turok is not here, but in the building, but not in this room. Otherwise,
he might object. He might object to a phase. I'm not sure he even would object to a phase of early accelerated expansion. He would. Okay. So with some objections, the case is very, very strong. But what caused it is a mystery. Scalar potential models, which I'm going to talk about here, will work. And by a scalar potential model, I mean just general relativity plus a minimally coupled scalar with a potential, hence the name scalar potential models. And they will work, and it's trivial to give a proof, a constructive proof, the strongest of all kinds of proofs that they will work. And that is, the way this would usually happen is that some rabid, foaming at the mouth particle theorist would say, here, listen to me, I've got this great model, you know, and he would try and tell you about that, and he would proceed from the model to infer what the geometry is, but to just prove that you can get basically whatever inflating geometry you want, let's play the game the other way around. That is, let's assume the scale factor is known, hence the Hubble parameter and the first slow roll parameter are all known explicit functions of time, and let's just show that you can easily, trivially, construct a potential which will support that inflation, hence it's for sure that these will work. And the way to do it is to write down the two non-trivial Einstein equations, the G0 equation and the coefficient of the trace part of the IJ part of the equation. And if you just add 1 and 2 together, then you get the potential to drop out. You get a equation for phi zero dot, the time derivative of the inflaton. And let's see, do we have any young American physicists here? Okay, good, we don't. So by performing an integral, which everybody outside my native country is still capable of doing, we can reconstruct the potential up to a sign choice, what's also a very, very difficult sign choice. For American physicists. We can just write then phi zero is equal to this now known explicit function of time. And under the assumption that epsilon really does lie in that range 0 to 1, then this is guaranteed to be positive. And then you just get some curve. It may be a complicated curve, but you do a complicated procedure of taking the graph. And so it's some curve that looks like that, or actually probably looks the other way around, but it doesn't even matter. You take the graph and flip it, and then instead of reading off t, taking t and reading off what phi is, you take phi and read off what t is. So it's for sure true that you can invert this graphically if no other way. It's obvious, right? And then the final step of the construction is you take equation 2 and now subtract it from equation 1 instead of adding the two. Now you get the kinetic energy term to cancel and the potentials add, and you wind up getting an explicit function of time, which, remember, A of t is known explicitly, and if you just plug in time is equal to that in terms of scalar field, that's your potential. So guaranteed, bet the farm, scalar potential models will work. Whatever model of inflation you want, as long as you don't have h dot ever go positive, you can certainly reconstruct a potential to do this. However, it gets pretty hard to believe. There's a big credibility problem. And I've isolated 6 fine-tuning problems. Again, I think everybody in this room is familiar with them. Initial conditions, you have to have potential energy dominate over kinetic energy and over spatial derivatives for more than about a Hubble volume. Numerical studies show basically 3 Hubble volumes. To get inflation to last long enough, you need this integral of the ratio of the potential and its derivative to be bigger than 50. To get scalar perturbations, which are measured, to come out with the right strength, you need this ratio of the potential to the third power and the derivative to the second power to be that number. To get tensor perturbations to be less than the observed amount, or less than the observed limit, you need G times V to be less than that. And then, very important for my current talk here, to get reheating to be efficient, to get something to occur with just gravitational couplings are not strong enough. You need to have couplings to normal matter. And finally, worst of all, the cosmological constant problem, you have to have the thing settle into a minimum, which is incredibly small. I think we have a question or probably an objection back here.
Perturbations is a fine-tuning because it's only a statement about the energy scale, and we know that there are energy scales below the Planck scale. Uh-huh. And we've got, you know, it's only a fine-tuning if you think inflation should happen at the Gut scale, but we don't know if there's any physics up there. If you think, you know, take a log prior on energy scales, inflation could happen at the TUV scale, and hence isn't a fine-tuning problem.
Okay, so you're not worried by this, but you do accept this as a condition, right?
That's
good. That's a condition. You're happy with it. Other people would regard it as a limit on the model, but it is for sure a condition, and you have to make the potential obey that.
Maybe the point is that there's already the Higgs hierarchy problem, which is more severe than this. So, I mean, since this is kind of, these are dwarfs for comparison with the Higgs hierarchy.
I think this dwarfs everything.
Right, exactly.
Okay, so I want to talk about number 5, and number 5, well, so first off, the response of sort of people that, without being insulting or pejorative, I might refer to as dirty cosmologists, by whom I mean people who really aren't interested in quantum field theory or loop corrections or dotting all the I's, crossing the T's. They just want to get data and predictions right away, right fast, get the Nobel Prize, get out. And those people's response to all of this is to just shrug their shoulders and say, well, look, I mean, I've got this free parameter V of phi. You just proved to me that you could get whatever A of T you wanted with it. I'll just fine-tune the sucker. And if I have to fine-tune it to get that to be true, I'll get that to be true. If I have to fine-tune it to get that to be true, I'll do that too. Whatever you need to do, that's what I'm going to do. And they'll just, and if you say, but come on, do you really believe that model? They'll shrug their shoulders and say, we're here, right? So it had to be true. And by the way, give me the Nobel Prize. Okay, so what I want to talk about is an obstacle to doing this. So I'm not going to criticize that, although one might. I'm going to say that even if you're that blasé about just doing whatever you have to in order to get agreement, there is still a fundamental obstacle to doing it. And that comes with point number 5, reheating. Gravitational couplings in the scalar-driven inflation are not, or this scalar potential model inflation are not strong enough to give efficient reheating, so you need to couple it to ordinary matter. The matter has to be light, okay? Otherwise, you're not going to create large numbers of them when the field oscillates and drives things through resonance. And that, I will try and convince you, provides an obstacle to fine-tuning that you cannot avoid, okay? And the idea is that that coupling is going to, through quantum corrections, going to induce Coleman-Weinberg-type corrections to the effective potential. How do we know this? We know it because we've done it in flat space. Sidney Coleman was my advisor. He did the calculation even before I came there. So so it's right. And in flat space, it takes the form of phi to the fourth times a logarithm of phi, and no question that it's right. And those guys, by the way, are not Planck suppressed, and they typically would wind up giving rise to corrections to the potential that are too steep. Okay, well, again, without making it pejorative, the people I might refer to as the dirty cosmologists knew this, of course. They know particle physics. And they just would shrug their shoulders and say, look, I've already fine-tuned the guy to one part in 10 to the 123. I'm just going to fine-tune it away. If you don't like that correction, no problem. I'll just adjust the classical potential to get rid of it. And what I want to try and convince you today is that they can't do that. There's an obstacle to doing that. The reason why is that these guys have to be light, so their mass is going to be small, and that means that really you should think of them as basically massless fields, the things that are engendering these loop corrections, which just acquire a mass due to the scalar, and that means that you can work out what their effective potentials look like, and we can't get it for a general geometry, I wish we can, but we can get it for De Sitter, and on De Sitter they don't at all take this very, very simple form. Much, much richer structure. They take the form of, so De Sitter is where h is just exactly constant. They take the form of h to the fourth times a function, which is a very, very complicated function. I'll show you explicitly what it is for different models, of the square of the coupling constant times the square of the field over the Hubble parameter squared.
So, Richard, these are the fields that inflaton is going to repeat into?
Yes, that's right.
And you're saying that there must be light during inflation.
That's right, yeah. They must be light compared with inflationary scales. Otherwise, you won't get a significant amount of free heat.
Why that has to happen before the end and not just at the end? Things can, can I explain that?
Having it happen at the end is okay, too. It does have to happen at the end. They have to be light compared.
But why at the beginning? I mean, when you're...
Well, if they're light compared, if they're light compared with the h at the end, then they're for sure light compared with the h at the end, at the beginning.
Can they be time dependent? Isn't everything time dependent?
Masses, could the masses be time dependent? Well, I think sort of orthodox opinion is that the temperature during inflation, so you're worrying about maybe temperature corrections to the field?
No, coupling with pi of phi is a time dependent value.
Sure it is, yes. That's explicitly what I'm looking at right here. That is exactly, that mass is exactly what's giving rise to the effective potential. That is, the effective potential, if you wanted to understand it in a very pedestrian way, is the sum over all k vectors of the plus or minus, depending on whether it's a fermion or a boson, half h bar omega of k. And that is exactly coming from the mass dependence that omega, which in flat space would be square root of k vector dot k vector, plus m squared is. It's exactly coming from the dependence that guy has on the scalar field. That's exactly where it's coming from.
But that's the one loop correction, so that there could be just the classical dependence.
Right. Why can't this mass be very large and flat, independent of phi?
It could be.
So then what would be the problem?
So you want to have it to be very large and flat?
Yeah. Until the end, some sort of hybrid.
Oh, okay. So what I'm going to talk about is a case where it isn't that, where it's actually small for all time. And you can always say, okay, well, then I can get out of it by creating a model like that, and that's fine with me. All I'm talking about is another condition on what you have to do in order to avoid problems.
Right, fine.
Okay? So they take this form, and I will, like I say, give you what they look like. You can see that this thing goes into the Kolmann-Weinberg limit, or I will show you that it goes into the Kolmann-Weinberg limit in the limit of large x. So it will establish an important correspondence limit, but the limit that's relevant to us is what happens near the end of inflation. Now, some of you are thinking about, and that's small x, some of you are thinking about, well, what if I have a large field inflation model? Doesn't matter. I would then, in my coupling, just have subtracted the VEV of the field wherever it's going to settle down. So it's always small field that's relevant to us. And you can set this term, the phi squared term, to 0 using a conformal counter term. And you can set the phi to the fourth term using a phi to the fourth counter term. But the other ones you just have to live with. And the problem with that is that the factors of h squared that appear in this very, very complicated mess are not constant. And in fact, they're not even local. And that means that they're not terms that you could just renormalize away. So if they were just constant, the people who, again, without making pejorative comments, I might refer to as dirty cosmologists, would just shrug their shoulders and say, hey, I don't care. I'm just going to fine-tune it away. You don't like that term? It's gone. But you cannot add terms to a classical action which are not local. You can't do that. That's a no-no. And let me make that case. And I'll make that case in the context of three models. First, another scalar, a fermion, and a vector boson, and that's the case where I'm dealing with a complex inflaton. For each model, I'll give the general form in De Sitter for the effective potential. I'll give the large field expansion so you can see the Coleman-Weinberg limit, and then I'll give the small field limit. And you might say, well, why don't I just do this for a general inflationary background? Oh, I only wish I could. We don't have the propagators. The rate limiting step in doing these calculations is to have the propagators, and we just don't have them. When you have a non-zero mass, which is what you have to have in order to look at an inflaton, or look at an effective potential, then the only background for which we know the propagators is De Sitter. You can, however, express things always in terms of a general scalar, even if you're dealing with a fermion or a vector. And the way that works is, suppose we had a general scalar. This is in the presence of an arbitrary geometry where that's the minimally coupled scalar D'Alembertian. There's an arbitrary conformal coupling. There's an arbitrary mass. And I'll call that guy I delta of xi and m squared. And it depends functionally on the 2 points that it's at and would obey that equation. We don't know this guy. We only know him for a De Sitter background. But if you had him, you could write down the fermion propagator for a mass m fermion in conformal coordinates. It would look like this, this combination of funny scale factors and derivatives acting on a structure function, which would take the form of 1 plus gamma 0 times one kind of scalar propagator of that type, and then 1 minus gamma 0 times another scalar propagator of that type. If you wanted a vector, then it would take the form of these projectors, these transverse projectors acting on the derivative of the invariant length from x to x prime times, again, a scalar structure function where that thing would be formed out of more combinations of these things. First, a difference of two of them at different mass squareds, and then a derivative of them with respect to the mass squared. So if only we had this guy, we could get everything. Okay, now what I promised I was going to show you is what these things look like for the different cases. So first off, for the scalar, the derivative of the scalar potential takes this form. You can write an exact expression for it in terms of things that you can't do. First, the two counter terms that you're allowed. Second, the coincidence limit of one of these scalar propagators, which again we only know for De Sitter, times that. We only know those things for De Sitter, and the result for De Sitter can be expressed in terms of these funny indices, nu plus or minus, which look like that, where that's the thing having to do with the conformal coupling, and the important field dependence, z squared is equal to the coupling constant h squared phi squared over capital H squared. I'll remind you that your favorite function, the digamma function, is defined as the derivative of the logarithm of the gamma function. The exact expression for what this thing looks like, if you just evaluate this for De Sitter, make a choice of the counter terms to cancel the phi squared and the phi to the fourth terms, that's done up here. The exact expression for it looks like this. And notice it's, as I told you, written in terms of integrals of digamma functions. So pretty ugly thing, quite a bit more complicated than the simple Coleman-Weinberg form. However, it does go to the Coleman-Weinberg form. If you just take the large field limit of the digamma function, then it does take this characteristic form of z to the fourth times logarithm of z squared, and then plus a whole series of other terms that look like that. Looks pretty ugly. The relevant limit for us is the small field limit, in which case it takes the form of, remember, I've killed the z squared and the z to the fourth just by choices of counter terms because I want to give the model the best chance of surviving.
Sorry, I missed what was z?
Z is the field times a coupling constant over the Hubble parameter. So thanks for asking that. Very important point over there.
And h is
the De Sitter Hubble parameter.
Okay. And that small h is small.
Oh, small h is the coupling constant of the scalar to. Where are we? I think I'm going in the wrong direction. Yes, thank you. One more, I think. It's the coupling between the inflaton and the spectator scalar that we're using to reheat the universe. Okay, so we do get the Coleman-Weinberg limit, but this thing looks pretty, well, I don't want to make an insensitive comment towards complexity-challenged mathematical expressions, but I think that's ugly, right? Okay, so how about for the fermion? Well, it looks like this. Again, the two counterterms plus the coincidence, or actually minus because of the Fermi minus sign, the coincidence limit of the Fermi propagator, which remember you can get from that general scalar propagator. And I'll define z again as coupling constant squared times field squared over Hubble parameter squared. And if you evaluate this for de Sitter and integrate, you get this expression, a little bit simpler now. A large part of the scalar complication was due to the need to allow for an arbitrary conformal coupling of the spectator scalar. Then you have, again, integrals of digamma functions. In this case, they're not even with real arguments.
Yeah.
However, it does recover the Coleman-Weinberg limit in the limit of large fields. So for large fields, it's got this z to the fourth logarithm of z, it correctly gives the Coleman-Weinberg limit. However, again, the one that's relevant for us is the small field limit, and there's a z to the sixth, z to the eighth, z to the tenth, and notice the minus sign coming from the Fermi minus sign. And finally, the vector case, it's more accurately expressed as a function of phi star phi, and it takes this term from the conformal counterterm, the phi to the four counterterm, and then the coincidence of the trace of the vector propagator. I'll define z squared as E squared, the electric charge squared, times phi star phi over h squared. And it takes this form where I've chosen those, again, to kill the z squared and z to the fourth terms in the small field limit. And then plus, again, integrals of digamma functions. Looks pretty ugly. But it does give the right large field limit to agree with Coleman and Weinberg. And then the small field expansion looks like that. So they're for sure there. Let me now make the critical point that those factors of h in these very ugly, very deeply complicated functions are not constant. And you might say, how in the world can you do that, Richard? Well, of course, I'm a particle theorist. I could just lie, right? I mean, that's what we do. But in this case, I actually don't have to lie. I can do the calculation because there's one other thing that we can look at. Even though we can't do calculations except on de Sitter background, I can look at the stress tensor, the expectation value of the matter stress tensor, which tells me about how the effective action depends upon the metric. And in particular, if the effective action had this delta V term, which is depending on Z, which is there, and if that guy had some general metric dependence, that's a way of probing it. It looks at one particular probe. It doesn't completely fix it, but it tells us something about it. And in particular, it tells us enough to tell for sure that those h squareds are not lambda over 3. So what would you get? Well, if h squared really was lambda over 3, what you would get is just that this, when you evaluated it for de Sitter, which you can do, is just minus g mu nu h to the fourth times that. That's not what you get. What you really get is minus g times h to the fourth times a more complicated thing, 1/2 z squared times f prime of z squared. And that's true for almost every term in that complicated mess, except for the scales, the dimensional regularization scales that occur in the delta C and delta lambda counterterms. I chose those to be H to get simpler expressions. You may not have thought that they were simpler, but they were simpler. And if I had, they should really have been constants. And if I had done that, then that relation would have been obeyed for those particular terms. But almost everything obeys that. And that tells you for sure that there's variation on the metric coming in those factors of h squared that occur there. That's the only way you get that derivative occurring there. It's consistent with h squared being r over 12, which is what it would be if you were in de sitter, what R would obey if you were in de sitter, and if only this had been all that occurs, would have been okay, because F of R models are okay. They're not unstable. You're allowed to add those, and F of phi squared over R would be okay too. A little weird, but it would be okay, and those could have been removed by our friend the dirty cosmologist. However, it ain't so. So to see that the factors of h squared are not r over 12, let's notice that the limit that's relevant for us is the small field limit. So what we can do is to just take this propagator, which we can't evaluate in a general background, and expand it around m squared equals 0. For example, the first term would be that, then an m squared term, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I didn't write them all down, but I think we know how to do that. And that's useful because this propagator is known for a far larger class of geometries. It's known for every case of constant epsilon geometries. And a lot is known about it. In particular, what typically happens is that the indices depend in a really complicated way on epsilon. For example, this is what you would get, right? And that is going to introduce very complicated functions of epsilon in the result, not at all consistent with R equals, in general, R would be equal to 6 times 2 minus epsilon times h squared in a general homogeneous and isotropic geometry. So how could you get those factors of epsilon, assuming you wanted still a local thing? You'd have to use higher curvatures. For example, one way to get it would be by algebraically solving for 2 over 2 minus epsilon is equal to 1 plus the square root of 1 minus 6g over r squared, where g is the Gauss-Bonnet invariant. Bad, 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 because that is a higher derivative theory ruled out by the theorem of Ostrogradsky. Those are not allowed in classical actions. So to the extent that that happens, and it surely does happen, you're not allowed to remove those counterterms. And indeed, it's even worse than that. The factors of h squared are not local. We've known this since for a long, long time, even before I started to work on inflation. This is what causes that funny ringing that occurs in the scalar power spectrum. If you imagine, you can exactly solve for the scalar power spectrum if you imagine having epsilon be constant and then make a sudden transition from one constant to another. Starobinsky wrote a nice paper on that in 1992. And a graph of what it looks like is this. So this is where I had a transition where epsilon 1 was 1 over 200, epsilon 2 is 1 over 100. And it made the transition at some delta n, which is given right here. And depending on when it makes the transition, the result for the final power spectrum shows ringing right there. This is the point where horizon crossing takes place. And you see that it's not at all what you would expect if it was local. If it was local, it must be just m1 over on this side, and it must just be m2 over on that side. We've known for ages that there's this ringing in the power spectrum. And that's not a local factor. You cannot write that even as a local thing, and that must be present. We actually recently, some new progress, me and a graduate student named Danny Brooker is in this paper, we actually were able to get a good analytic approximation for what that ringing is for arbitrary epsilon of t. So we just have some functions where you give me what epsilon of t is, and I can tell you what the source is and what this frequency is, and then you can express the result as an integral over e foldings times the sine of an integral over e foldings of some source over a frequency, and that will be pretty much, you know, within 8 significant figures or so accurate for what you get. And notice again, that's not local, right? It's got an integral there. This is not going to be local. Those are no-nos. You cannot add that kind of stuff to a classical action. Verboten. Okay, but you might, again, our dirty cosmologist guy is just getting impatient at this point. He's saying, look, I want my Nobel Prize. What are you telling me all this garbage? H is almost constant. Let's just fine-tune it away at one point. It doesn't change much, and then we're okay, right? Okay, so that has to do with, so I hope I've established for you that it's a problem in principle. Now let's see whether it's a problem in practice. And that I can't give you a definitive result on. I can just tell you that it doesn't look real good. So what you could do is to just use the arbitrariness of V of phi to fine-tune it away at one point, right? the corrections are going to look like phi squared over h squared. H takes a whole range of values, right? It changes during scalar-driven inflation. You could just fine-tune it away at one point, say near the beginning of inflation, and then see what happens. But that's a little bit problematic because H typically changes a lot. So for these monomial models, which are now, I think, pretty heavily disfavored for high values of alpha anyway, you can show that H of t over the initial value of H goes like a power alpha over 4 of the scale of the first law role parameter over its initial value, right? And that's going to be changes of factors of 2 or something like that. That's just too much, right? If the delta V was bad at one value, and you can renormalize it away for one for something, and then it changes, then the argument changes by a factor of 2 or 4 or something, it's just not going to work. Another option, though, is you are allowed to use F of R models. So you could, instead of renormalizing it away at just one instant, you could actually choose, you could say all those factors of H squared, I want to make them exactly R over 12, even though that isn't right. I want to make them exactly R over 12 and choose it to cancel at one instant. And then it's only going to deviate a little bit more slowly. That you can do that, but then you're going to get a modified gravity theory due to the R dependence of that. For example, the Friedmann equation is going to change because those factors, the variations of those factors of R are going to introduce G mu nus, which you'll have to put over on the other side and solve for. I can't actually say that that's going to be bad or not. I think you need a careful numerical study, and it's going to be necessarily model dependent. But that's what I can say right now. So conclusions. Via phi models, I think everybody can agree, well, maybe not everybody agrees, need heavy fine-tuning. Reheating requires couplings to light matter. Those induce Coleman-Weinberg-type corrections to via phi. Those guys are not Planck-suppressed. You can't compute them for general first law role parameter. You can get them for epsilon equals 0. And for epsilon equals 0, they take this very complicated form. And I showed you explicitly, it involves integrals of digamma functions, icky stuff. Those factors of H squared that occur in De Sitter, which is the one geometry for which you can evaluate it exactly, are not constant. They aren't also R over 12. That already tells you that you would need to exactly cancel them. You would need forbidden counterterms. And they're not even local, in fact. So you can't remove them by more fine-tuning of phi, although you may, of V, although you may be able to remove them in practice for certain models. And that looks, I don't know about you, I guess opinion might differ, that looks kind of bad to me. But even if you're shrugging your shoulders and say, look, just give me the Nobel Prize, stop all this garbage, get it, you know, I got my ticket book already for Stockholm. We can at least, I think, all admit that this is a new constraint that we have to be careful about to look at and see, and we have to come up with a model. We have to devise models that avoid this particular kind of problem. Okay, thanks very much for your attention. I'm done. Weili.
I guess it's new way he would say, okay, so you should now give up on inflation and buy into ectoic or something, and that's the...
I should apologize to the particle theorist present here. We're supposed to lie, right? And so what I would do is just normally tell lies and bullshit and get out of it. And I've tried to be honest with you about it and be honest about the problems. But I don't think we ought to give up on inflation. I'm excited about inflation. I'm jazzed about it. I think the data in favor of it is overwhelming. We do need to look for better ways of generating it. But just admitting that there are problems with existing mechanisms for generating it does absolutely not, to my mind, mean that we need to give up on it. Absolutely not. I would say, again, that I'm sure you read that paper that Will wrote, Inflation or What, where he shows just how you have to stand on your head in order to avoid overwhelming evidence in favor of an early phase of accelerated expansion. I would just say that we need to then be careful, and we need to try and find ways that that avoid these sorts of issues, but definitely not give up on inflation. Yes?
So I guess I want to understand the nature of the problem. Usually the argument against fine tuning is that if you have a shift symmetry which is softly broken, then you could have a slow roll inflation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, wouldn't that shift symmetry also suppress this type of corrections from other light fields?
Well, show me how you're going to enforce the shift symmetry on the coupling to matter. So, actually, let me.
I think your coupling all break shift symmetry.
Yes, they all do. So how would you, so again, I'm totally open to ways to making it work. This kind of a coupling certainly breaks shift symmetry. That kind of a coupling certainly breaks shift symmetry. And that kind of a coupling also breaks shift symmetry. So the shift the approximate shift symmetry that exists in the scalar potential model doesn't do us any good as far as coupling to ordinary matter.
You just put a function of phi there that is flat. I mean, this might be ugly, but as a technical point, if you just put a function of the scalar that is a constant during the 50 fold, and then it's not a constant, then it's fine.
Well,
then it has a shift symmetry during the period of inflation, and it doesn't have, and then the couplings to matter turn on at that particular.
I think you might actually. So by the way, this is. I definitely am not trying to make a no-go theorem. It's just too, the class of models is too general to come up with it. So all I'm advertising this as is a new constraint that we have to worry about. And that's a very interesting idea. Just a priori, I think that you might actually encounter a worse problem associated with that, namely that then the Coleman-Weinberg corrections are small during most of inflation, and then all of a sudden at the end of inflation they turn on. That looks to me something that's going to may endanger graceful exit. But it's, I would say, a model-dependent thing, and we need to put this constraint in along with the other constraints listed as number 7 and consider carefully.
For example, for the scalars, I think we have a very the absence of a local non-Gaussianity kind of implies that there's no light scalar other than the time the pi. So. You know, other things, I don't know, but so I don't know if this is natural or not, but the data seems to imply that we don't have anything light, at least another scalar that is light, in addition to the clock fluctuation. So, okay, I don't know why that is or whatever, but so that it seems, that seems to be the case.
Yeah, so my only comment is, again, just that if you did that, if you had it had a big mass and then have the mass drop to, you obviously have to have the mass drop to almost zero, or it's effectively zero at the end of inflation. That's right. Otherwise, you're not going to create particles. Then it looks like you're going to get this Coleman-Weinberg type potential to turn on right at the end of inflation. Maybe is going to be a problem with graceful exit. Don't know. But that's what I want to have happen, is to have this constraint added to the mix of other constraints, and then we'll try and see what we get. Other questions? Weili, this is your second.
Obviously, even the standard model has various parameters that are fine-tuned. Would you view these, your six, seven constraints worse than what we probably list a similar number for just a standard model, which...
Well, I guess I probably review that one as pretty bad, much worse than the Higgs problem. So I'm not going to pass judgments about what's bad and what's good. These are constraints that we have to meet, and I just want to tell you about a new one that I think we have to meet.
But if you take take one of your models and. Calculations and compute, say, tune it, make it a small flat potential at the beginning, how bad it gets, or after how many e-foldings does epsilon get to?
That's right. So
when you put the age, some number, what
that's right.
How much is the time?
Well, so there's two ways one can think about doing that. One, I can get a definitive result. The other, I think we're going to just have to do it numerically. The one way that I can think of doing it definitively is where you just fine-tune it away at one instant, say at the beginning of inflation. Then it's just an issue of you ask how much does H change during inflation, and for sort of a plain vanilla model of inflation, it changes a lot because epsilon you know, starts out very, very small, 0.005 or something, and at the end of inflation, it's one. So that's, you know, a big number. And
so most of these change happens at the very end.
Yeah, depending on the model, would happen at the end. And again, that's not necessarily good either. That might induce problems, introduce problems with graceful exit. So it's issues that we have to worry about. The harder one to analyze that I think requires a detailed numerical study, and that can only be done, of course, with specific models, is if you try and be a little bit more ambitious. If you say, look, I'm going to take account of the changing of H in a rough way, in an approximate way, by interpolating these factors of H squared as R over 12. That won't be exact, but it will capture a lot of the change of.
But even if you do the first one and H changes by factors of whatever, 50 or something like that, then.
Oh, I think that's likely to be that's likely to be way too much.
Is it linear in this parameter? Yeah, there were some H's in front of
the right. So the small field limit, so good question. The small field limit is going like H to the 4 times this thing, Z to the 6, where Z is going like coupling constant times scalar over Hubble parameter. So that's going to go like 1 over H squared. And if you have that guy change by factors of 50 or something, I think you're in big trouble.
Meaning it's a part in a 50, 150 squared or something, fine-tuning. I just want to have some, a part in a million, a part in 123?
Well, it's something that you just can't fine-tune away. See, it's not, the way to think about it is not that that there's some parameter that we have to fine-tune to one part in 50. It's that there's something that we just can't change about the theory. So we could cancel this term at the beginning of inflation when
H is proportional to the coupling constant, right? So I could change the coupling constant at the expense of making repeating less efficient.
Right, exactly so.
Why would this be bad? I don't know. Would this be bad? I don't know.
Well, I guess then it gets to be a numerical issue about how big a change you're interested in the potential and versus how efficient you want reheating to be. It seems to me that you're likely to have to, just from other types of fine-tuning, you're likely to have to fine-tune things to, you know, within 10 to the 16 or something like that. That looks kind of bad.
That's the number I want to get. What is the factor? 10 to 16?
So that's an excellent question. I don't have a definitive answer for you. My feeling is that it's going to be like the phi to the 4 term if you had not Higgs inflation, but if you had the vanilla brand Higgs inflation without the big conformal coupling. My feeling is it's going to be like that. But it's an excellent question. And that's the kind of studies that we need to have to quantify just how bad the problem is. So this, I think, establishes that there's a problem in principle. How bad it is in practice, if you just say, okay, look, I cancel the guy at one instant, how bad does it get later on? How much does it screw things up later on? That, I think, we have to look at it in detailed numerical studies and also in the context of particular models. It looks kind of scary to me, but maybe I'm not sanguine enough. Other questions? Okay.
All right, let's thank Richard for our time today.